Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. We want to check in again with WBUR reporter Alex Ashlock, who's in Copley Square at the Boston Marathon finish line on this warm and sunny Patriots Day. Hello again, Alex.
Good afternoon, Deborah.
So the race is still going, and as we said, it is warm today. It was warmer earlier. How are people doing, and what do they appear to look like when they cross the finish line?
It's kind of a funny day for the marathon. It's not really that warm. It's in the 50s, but there were no clouds really today. So the bright sunshine is just beating down on these runners throughout the race. And the ones that are crossing the finish line now have been out there for maybe 3-4 hours. So they've been in that sun for the entire time. So I did talk to a couple of people who did struggle with the heat. It was cool kind of at the beginning of the race, and they maybe went out too fast, and they paid for that. As they came down the home stretch, I talked to a woman from Nashville who finished and told me that she struggled a bit. So kind of a sneaky day weather-wise, you know, not really that hot, but it still is taking a bit of a toll on the runners.
Also, some of the survivors of the 2013 marathon bombings are running today.
Yeah.
How are they doing? Do you know, Alex? Did you see any of them? Yeah, what does it mean to them today, do you think?
It means an incredible amount. Patrick Downs, he lost one of his legs. His wife lost her leg as well. He's running today while she cheers him on, her recovery not going quite as well as him. He did finish the race today in 5 hours and 56 minutes. He crossed the finish line, so he celebrated. There were about 30 survivors of the bombing who ran in the marathon today. Another who lost a limb, Adrian Hazlett Davis, the professional dancer who lost a limb, she's also running the race. I saw her early on. She's still out there hoping to finish, so we'll see if she crosses the finish line and is able to celebrate that accomplishment after losing so much in the marathon bombings 3 years ago.
Also, the Olympics are affecting this race, right? Some of the top Americans have skipped the race this year. Can you explain?
That's right. Yeah, the top three Americans on the men's and women's side, they qualified for the Olympic Games in February in Los Angeles. I was there for that race. So they're skipping Boston. They don't need to run another marathon before they run one in Rio in August. A lot of them were here, though, to watch what happened. The African runners, very prominent today, of course. They're competing for spots on their Olympic team. They don't have a one-day Olympic trial like we do, so their athletic federations pick their Olympians. So we had three men finish 1, 2, 3 in the men's race, three Ethiopians. So we were asking them about whether they thought they'd earned berths on the Olympic team, and they kind of smiled and said, well, it's kind of up to the federation. We don't really know. So there's also the London Marathon coming up on Sunday. So that will also help decide, I think, for especially these African countries like Ethiopia and Kenya, will probably be picking their marathon teams based on what happened here in Boston today and what happens in London on Sunday.
And when can we expect the last runners to cross the finish line, Alex?
I think there'll be runners crossing the finish line probably after 6 o'clock tonight. I know Dave McGilvery, the race director, goes out and runs the course after he feels like he's done his duty as race director. So we may see him cross the finish line later tonight. But right now, hundreds, thousands of Boston Marathon finishers now. They can call themselves finishers. They get that medal draped around their neck. They're crossing the line still here in Copley Square.
All right, WBUR's Alex Ashlock at the Boston Marathon finish line. Alex, thanks again so much for all your terrific work today.
You're welcome.
And it was 50 years ago that the first woman crossed the Boston Marathon finish line, even though it was a men's-only race at that time.
No one knew that women could run marathon distances. Women didn't even know they could run marathon distances because they were never allowed to run more than the mile and a half that was sanctioned by the Amateur Athletic Union.
Bobby Gibb challenged that when she started the race in Hopkinton in 1966. Gibb spoke with Radio Boston's Meghna Chakrabarty recently about why she ran the Boston Marathon.
I first saw it in 1964. I went out there with my dad, and it was totally irrational, but I just decided to run. Something deep inside me decided that I was going to run that race. I was going to be part of it. And it was like falling in love. it just happens. And I just started training. I had no idea how to train. I had no books, no coach. I had no running shoes. I wore a nurse's shoes because it was the only sturdy woman's shoe I could find. And in those days, for a grown woman to run was way outside the social norm. Mm-hmm. It was improper for a grown woman to run.
Unladylike?
Especially in public. And so women didn't run.
Yeah.
But I knew I was doing something I wasn't supposed to do, and I was in a place I wasn't supposed to be, and I thought I might get arrested. I knew if the officials saw me, they'd try to stop me.
So I understand that you hid in some bushes near the starting line?
Well, I wore my brother's Bermuda shorts.
Oh, that's right, and a hoodie.
And a hood.
And the shorts were tied together with some twine.
With some string.
Yeah.
And
a new pair of men's shoes, size
yeah, boys,
six. Yeah,
boys' size 6 running shoes, which I didn't realize you had to
break them in.
And so I found some bushes as near to the start as I could and waited, and the starting gun went, and the men went, and I waited about half the pack went by, and I jumped in.
Yeah. And in 1966, there were, what, like a couple, 500 or so runners?
Yeah, about 420, something like that.
This is so remarkable, Bobby, because you're wearing a hoodie and your brother's shorts. But the first thing I wondered is like, okay, so maybe you didn't get caught by the cops, but the runners themselves certainly recognized pretty soon that there was a woman in their midst, right?
Yeah.
And they didn't out you or anything, did they?
No. This was kind of a crucial moment.
Yeah.
Because they could have easily shouldered me off. I was unprotected. I was just there. So very quickly, the men behind me, studying my anatomy from the rear, despite the baggy shorts, realized I was a woman. And I could hear them talking. And is that a girl? Is that a woman? And so I laughed and turned around and smiled, and they were happy. They said, I wish my wife would run. I wish my girlfriend would run. And I said, but I'm afraid if I take off this heavy sweatshirt, they'll see I'm a woman, but it's getting really hot, and I'm afraid they'll throw me out. And they said, we won't let them throw you out. It's a free road. So the men were friendly and protective. They were like brothers. We were like, yeah, we were sharing life together.
Yeah. See, what amazes me is, okay, that's just such a wonderful and important point to make, that the runners were supportive of you, and they even sort of protected you from possibly being pulled off the course. But then there's also just the act of running the Boston Marathon, because you didn't know the course, right?
Right.
So as you were encountering different parts of it, like Heartbreak Hill, like, what was that like for you?
I didn't know, but I knew that I had a huge responsibility resting on my shoulders, and if I failed to finish, I would end up setting women back another 50 or 100 years. And so I was holding myself back, running way slower than I was running, usually would run. Of course, very quickly, the press realized that there was a woman running. History in the making here. And when I got to Wellesley, the women were waiting for me, and they're looking for me and scanning the runners, looking for me. And then when they saw me, they let out a huge shriek.
Yeah, I mean, it's the truest form of the Wellesley scream tunnel.
Yeah, it was really a scream tunnel. And there's one woman going, Ave Maria, Ave Maria. She was an older woman that had children around her, and there were tears running down her eyes. It was a very moving moment. It's like we all knew at that moment that the world was never going to be the same, that we were not ever going to fit back into that little box that we've been kept in for so long. And we ran on and on and on. And then Heartbreak Hill, my feet were starting to hurt.
Those new shoes. Yeah.
And I didn't know you're supposed to drink water. So I was running the whole race with no water. It's pretty dehydrated. So it was the feet that really got me. And then coming down the other side of Heartbreak was actually harder on the fronts of my legs, and then my pace really started to drop off, because it was just so excruciatingly painful to put my feet down on the ground each time.
Yeah. I read that not only did you want to finish, of course, but you wanted to finish with a particular poise, because there was this point that you were trying to prove about that there was no reason why women couldn't do this just as well as men. I mean, with all the pain that you were in from those blisters, I would say that it didn't matter how you finished, but I mean, did you feel like you finished in the way that you wanted to?
No, I actually felt disappointed. I felt like this was not one of my better runs. It was, you know, I almost felt like a feeling of failure for a while. And I said, oh, gosh, I wonder if anyone's going to be at the finish when I get there. I could feel my pace dropping until it was taking me as long to run a mile as it had to run, you know, 5 or 6 miles. And it turned out I had actually finished in a pretty good time of 3 hours and 21 minutes and 40 seconds ahead of two-thirds of the pack.
I was going to say, like, the way you're making it sound is you had a terrible finish, but you didn't.
Yeah,
more than 300 other racers that you beat.
Well, yeah. I wasn't reeling against the men.
You finished ahead of them.
Really crossed my mind that I was running against anybody. I just was trying to do the best I could. And I knew I could do better. And so, you know, it was... But on the other hand, I was making a point.
I mean, the press was obviously mobbing you afterwards,
yeah.
Right? And then you gave this press conference.
Yeah.
And what kind of questions did they ask you? Like, what were you trying to prove?
Where was I from, and why did I run? I said, I ran it for fun because I loved to run. I wanted to give the idea that if I could run it, anybody could. Well, they described me as a shapely blonde housewife.
Oh, dear.
So I figure if a shapely blonde housewife can run a marathon, then anyone can.
Yeah. And they mobbed you at your house, too. And this is such an amazing part of the story, right? They mobbed you at your house and they wanted to get pictures of you in the kitchen.
Yeah. They asked me to put on a dress. And so I put on a polka dot dress and was making fudge in the kitchen. So they had the two pictures on the front page. It was front page headlines. And one of me running in the Bermuda shorts and one of me making fudge sort of to prove I was a woman. I think people do tend to think in stereotypes, and it was really hard for people to merge those two images of a woman.
Yeah, so this is the thing. I mean, it's amusing to hear of it now, but in all honesty, it's disturbing because you had just done this monumental thing to prove, and you proved it beyond the shadow of any doubt.
Well,
of course women can do this, but the way that the media wanted to portray it at the time is almost as if, oh, she did this, but she's still a woman.
Right,
because look,
right.
We have pictures of her in a polka dot dress in the kitchen.
Right,
I mean,
it's as if
somehow you had threatened the idea of femininity.
No, so I was trying to make a whole new image of what it is to be woman.
Yeah.
You can be strong and fast and smart and competent and powerful and still be an incredibly feminine woman. Let's redefine what it is to be feminine.
I mean, I have to read one of the headlines here.
Okay.
This was from the then Boston Record American. It's front page.
Yeah.
Hub bride, first gal to run marathon. That was the headline with the two pictures you were talking about.
Right.
And then in the editorial in the paper, they said, a girl in the marathon, egad, is nothing sacred.
I know.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, looking at that and hearing your descriptions of life at the time, I can completely see why this was politically, spiritually, physically, sort of existentially important for you to do.
Yeah, yeah. It really was a pivotal moment in changing people's consciousness about women. And then more and more women began to run. And so I ran the next year, and there were two of us.
Mm-hmm.
In the yet-to-be-sanctioned women's division race. And then there were five of us in the yet-to-be-sanctioned women's division race. And finally, in 1972, thanks to Nina Kusick, who brought a petition to the AAU, the AAU changed their rules and began to sanction women's marathons.
Yeah, I mean, so it took time. I mean,
it takes time.
In the very year after you ran, when you said that there were two of you, it was you and Kathy Schweitzer, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, who the race director, Jock Semple, at the time tried to physically remove her
He was trying to get that number because it was an illegal number in the men's division race.
Because she had registered with her initials.
She wasn't qualified to run in the men's division race. And if there's an unqualified runner in a race, it jeopardizes the accreditation of that race.
I see.
And it means that all the running times of the men are invalidated. It's a shame that he gets so much bad publicity because he was such a sweet guy.
Mm. Yeah. You know, you're a woman of incredibly generous spirit, I have to say.
Thank you.
Yeah, because, I mean, it seems as if, like, really one of the undercurrents under this whole story is that you were doing things against the odds. You were doing things in opposition to roles and strictures that society had for you. I mean, even just hearing you talk about Jock Semple, You don't strike me as the kind of person who ever sees the negative.
No. If somebody, he was an honest man. He had a lot of integrity, and he was doing what he thought was right.
So, in the 50 years since you first ran, we're seeing that more than 164,000 women have completed the Boston Marathon. That's according to the BAA itself. How does that feel to you?
That's amazing. I love it. I mean, this is just what I wanted to happen. I wanted society to change the way it has, and it has changed in a much more egalitarian, open, free, incredibly creative society we have.
I do want to talk for a second about the fact that you and the 26.2 Foundation, which is a nonprofit dedicated to promoting and supporting marathons, that you're working together to put one of your sculptures of a female runner along the Boston Marathon route somewhere.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
It'll be the first female sculpture, and we were going to do it of Joan Benoit. And Joan said, well, if you really have to, but I'd rather that you did it of you. And I said, no, I can't do it of myself. That is so embarrassing.
Well, I guess my final question for you, Bobby, is in 2016, what's the equivalent thing that a young woman could do that's along the lines of what you did in 1966?
Well, I don't know. I think if there's any women out there who look out into the world and see these are problems that need to be solved, I think if women come together and work together, there's nothing that we can't do. And I'd say include men in this, too. If we all come together and work together, we can create a beautiful world.
Well, Bobby Gibb was the first woman to complete the Boston Marathon when she first ran it 50 years ago. This year, she's the race's grand marshal. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you, Bobby. Thank you so very much.
Well, it's been great. Thank you for inviting me to come on. I've really enjoyed this.
For more information about the sculpture that Bobby Gibb and the 26.2 Foundation are trying to place along the marathon route, go to our website, radioboston.org. And before we go today, we should say congratulations to the Boston Globe and the other winners of the 2016 Pulitzer Prizes for Journalism. The Globe's Jessica Rinaldi won for feature photography. Farrah Stockman, who's now with the New York Times, also won for a Globe series examining race and education in Boston after busing. And former Boston Globe reporter Wesley Lowery, who's now with the Washington Post, was part of the team that won the Pulitzer for national reporting for its coverage of fatal shootings by police officers. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Emma Jean Weinstein, Kathleen McNerney, and Jamie Bologna. We had help today from Adam Asher, Virginia Marshall, and Allison Bruzek. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hati. I'm Deborah Becker. Happy Patriots Day, and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.